work.
No, the next question I got is that it's this is a difficult subject because he's picked because it seems to me, he says, to do research and whatnot, and the reason I thought to come to you is because you've been through it all, but is that I was under the impression there was a hell of a lot more going on, because I always forget about the Depression. When did the Depression actually start?
The Depression began, of course, in 1929.
And it went 10 years, right?
So the war, basically.
All right, so in like the late 30s, let's say 38, 39, did things start changing a lot more since all the European people were here?
Yes, from that point of view, yes. The state of the American composer didn't change.
All right, that's...
I mean, my state happened to change because I was one of those fortunate guys who got one of the few university jobs around. And this was pure accident because I had gone to study with Roger, and because Roger got a job, therefore I got a job.
Because I want to it would be much easier for me to write a paper on European composers because of Schoenberg and Weber and Berg. But the thing is
what are you supposed to be doing? What are you supposed to be
doing?
What are you supposed to be doing?
Well,
the American composers, look, the only ones you have to concern yourself about for that period were the categories. The categories for this, you had the fairly...
Let's go from tonal to not experimental.
Well, but they were changing. See, right, that's a reasonable statement only in the vaguest terms.
Yeah.
Copland was considered a very radical composer. He was a modernist. Damreich said of his, you know, if a man can write a symphony like this at his age, he'll be murdering people next year. Aaron was considered very far up. It's a symphony for organ and orchestra that you probably never heard in your life.
The third symphony is the one
Okay. The piece that was known was Music for the Theater. The piece that was a little bit known was the Concerto for Piano. Then, but the Piano Variations was the one that was making absolutely a modern
last year composer.
That became a very influential and very widely known piece among musicians, but had no popular.
But the thing is that
it was published by Alma Morgan.
The reason I had asked before about the complexity of works is because you look at Schoenberg's String Trio, or his early string quartets, the ones that weren't quite 12-tone yet, like the second string quartet, and you look at the decisions that he used, it stands out much more than if you look at Copland's music. It looks so simplistic.
No question.
Was it because the thought of theory
let's
was...
Talk, no, let's know? Talk about this. The reason was the tradition that they found for themselves, Tom. Remember that there was not a single well-known American composer who had gone to Germany to study with Schoenberg or study with any of his disciples, except, believe it or not, Mark Blitzstein. Mm-hmm. But Mark Blitzstein, for political reasons, turned against all of that and, of course, wrote things like The Cradle of Rock, wrote this old court file stuff. The other composers had gone, either like Copland, to Paris to study with Boulanger, which was a totally anti-Schoenberg tradition. It was a Ravel, Debussy, Poiré tradition, Poulenc tradition. Or they had stayed here. If they stayed here by that time, they might have gone to the Eastman School. That was about the only place that composers went by way of the conservatory. Because of Howard Hanson, because he played their works, because he had an orchestra. And if composers such as David Diamond and others went there and couldn't get along with Howard Hanson.
And how well was Howard Hanson doing at that time?
He had a different kind of following. His following was among the school teachers and the music teachers in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. He was regarded as a solid conservative composer writing romantic music. He was anti-everybody. He was anti-Schoenberg. He was anti-Stravinsky. He was anti-everything except maybe Sibelius and his own tradition. He was a Scandinavian, as you know, so he was very much in a different kind of tradition. He was very, very anti. Now, if you got to Eastman and found you couldn't stand Hanson and couldn't get along with him, his ideology or his music, you would turn to a man there named Bernard Rogers, who was a very influential teacher, and at least knew something of, let's say, Richard Strauss. You didn't get Schoenberg anywhere. You didn't get Webern anywhere. You didn't even get Stravinsky, late Stravinsky, anywhere, except at Harvard. In the 30s, they began to develop a neoclassical tradition. That was Pistol. He, too, had studied with Boulanger. Harris had studied with Boulanger. But at Harvard, they were beginning to be influenced by the fact that Stravinsky was in Paris, that Stravinsky had become part of the French society, and it was beginning to be sort of a Stravinsky outpost. When Roger went to Princeton, and then I followed him, Princeton became sort of the, well, basically sort of the Shanker-Schoenberg outpost. Though Roger at that time was not at all, what should I say, Schoenberg influenced his composer. The only one of those composers whom he had any real, I would say, affection was Berg. He didn't become a 12-time composer until the late 40s, the early 50s. What else did you have? Virtually nothing, except a group of composers in New York who regarded themselves as sort of professionally radical composers. Two kinds of radicals. First of all, the political radicals. They were writing, of course, music, worker songs, imitation Shostakovich. I won't name their names because I suppose they'd be embarrassed by it. Henry Collins was one of them. There was, of course, the Stalinist influence. Then there were the other radicals. I mean, they were members of the Communist Party. These were openly avowed communists. They published a magazine called Musical Vanguard. That was very chic. Then there were the composers who regard themselves as musically radical, but absolutely American radicals. They, I think, would have felt that they were sort of, call them what you will, inheritors of the Ives attitude and not of the Ives techniques.
Yeah, now where was he?
Well, he was already by that time lost and stopped composing. Well, I was a very sick man. Music was not being performed very much, and I must confess that most of us didn't have any interest in it, as I never did. But there were composers, Ruth Crawford, Wallingford Grieger, Henry Brandt, and outside of New York, John J. Becker, who regarded themselves as being American radicals, doing their own thing, who either were doing things that were more interesting than Schoenberg and Webern and Berg, or had done all of those things first and were now doing better things. They were published in New Music magazine, basically. They were heard very little, they had very little influence, and they stood very much apart from Sessions or Copland or Harris or Piston, though those people really did not have a great deal in common and did not regard themselves as having a great deal in common.
You know, this New Music magazine you're talking about.
Right.
When they published a piece, like they published a piece before,
right.
Did they just publish, was it like a magazine like Time magazine?
There was no text at all. There was no text. It was soft-bound. It was a score.
And if one wanted to perform a piece out of this, they would have to copy the parts themselves.
Yes, there were no parts. You're absolutely right.
And did they?
But there were very few chamber
music. About performances.
There were very few chamber music pieces. That's a very good question. I have to answer that two ways. Most of the pieces published were vocal pieces. Published a Schoenberg of piano piece. They did publish, however, a small chamber work of Webern. And eventually, by the way, when they did publish chamber music, they did supply parts. They also had an orchestral series in which they published Ruggles and Ives and Wallingford Grieger.
I'm glad you brought that up. Now, Carl Ruggles, at what point was he in the third?
Carl Ruggles was out of it completely. He lived in Vermont. His music was seldom played, though it was known. It was even less known than Ives. He wrote very little music. A few of his little piano pieces were played. The Granites. Is that what it was known?
Because Stephen Merritt played his piano sonata.
His piano sonata?
Yeah. Carl Ruggles' piece.
It must be a very early unpublished piece.
It's published by the same people who published Barber's piano sonata.
Well, that would be Sherman. It must be very early, yeah. He wrote two big orchestral, I mean, he wrote very, very little. He wrote a piece called Men and Mountains.
That's what's being done here.
Yeah. Men and Mountains, a piece called Portals, a piece called Angels, and then he wrote these few little piano pieces. That's it. The piano sonata, I have never heard.
This is fairly odd.
Yeah. He
doesn't write anymore.
He's long dead. Yes, it is, he lived through the end. No, well, Carl Ruggles died at the age of 90 or so, and that was a number of years ago. Carl Ruggles is older than I was, or at least as old. He's in that generation. But I did know Carl Ruggles. Carl Ruggles was a great friend of Perez's, and he lived in Vermont and had nothing much to do with American Musical Society. Remember, that there was a hangover from the 20s, which obviously I don't know anything about directly. There had been a group called the International Musical Guild, which was founded by Berez.
Right.
They published, I'm sorry, they performed some Schoenberg, they performed Ruggles, they performed various composers from Europe and from here. They were very much, very much in antagonism to the League of Composers, but they had very quickly. Berez, for example, was a composer who was known from the past. He was almost never performed in the 30s. One piece of his was recorded, his ionization. One movement or two movements from his octandre had been recorded in the Columbia History of Music. Pieces were never to be heard, certainly not the orchestral pieces. They were not heard again in the 50s. Maybe late 40s.
So things, they started picking up in the end of the 30s. After the war. There was a drop-off again in the 40s, right?
Well, the war, after all, scrambled everything. Just forget the war. I mean,
They shut down everything.
Yeah. During the war, after all, it was a considerable war. After the war, things began to happen.
I have to ask you this. In relationship to the serious music,
right?
You've got Big Band here in the 30s, right?
Oh, sure.
Okay. Now, it seems that the majority of people were swinging toward the Big Band here, right?
Who you mean? You mean the masses?
The populace, yeah.
Sure, of course, sure, yeah. Oh, that was it. Oh, they were. Yes, it was an incredible era.
So you had Woody Herman and Artie Shaw and all those folks. And Benny Goodman.
Benny Goodman and Glenn Miller and go on and on and on and on.
All right. So they're the counterpart to the serious music. I mean, they are what was being actually...
Oh, they're the counterpart to what rock is today.
Yeah, but I mean, they not in relationship to serious music, they were the ones being performed. Benny Goodman's junk and...
Well, Benny Goodman didn't write Benny Goodman.
Yeah, but I mean, those are arrangers that were writing those groups. I mean, it wasn't really serious composition.
No, but there was no nobody. Nobody ever confused the two. There was confusion between them whatsoever. There
but
was
the
no
thing
intersection
is that,
at all.
Now, the concert draw in the 30s was how much? I mean, did a lot of people go to concerts, or was it still a very small?
No, I think probably more people. Look, I don't know the figures.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
I would think that more people went than now. Remember that after all, there were some rather celebrated conductors around. Toscanini was conducting. Klemperer was conducting here.
Mahler was at the Met.
Oh, no.
Not the Lehrer?
Lehrer died in 1911.
Yeah. Oh, so Mahler was at the Met previously.
Mahler was
at the Met. Was Toscanini at the Met?
No, Toscanini was at the Philharmonic.
Oh, well,
then he took over the NBC orchestra. There were, Brzezinski was here. I mean, Bruno Walter. All of these people came here. No, the Philharmonic was very much functional. The pianists, the virtuosi, were everywhere. There were big concerts at Carnegie Hall by every pianist you can think of, from Rachmaninoff down. There was concerts all over the place. Almost none of them had any kind of contemporary music. There was nothing, for example, like, not only we've already said it, the chamber music groups we have now, there was not as much contemporary music on the programs of the Philharmonic. There was not as much contemporary
commission-wise.
There were no records, because there was no LP. Commissionings, there were no commissions. There were, so rarely as to be
well, then
worth
the composer,
mentioning.
The composer
there was no found. There was no Koussevitzky Foundation to commission. There was no NEA. There was a Guggenheim, which was entirely in the hands, almost as now, of the most conservative composers imaginable. I didn't even try to get
Ford Foundation wasn't in.
Ford Foundation didn't exist. Rockefeller Foundation didn't exist for music. None of this existed. None of this was there.
Now, with that in mind...
Young composer had no hope of a commission.
Now, with that in mind, people like Sessions and Copeland and Harris, they were just writing pieces like I do and say, hey, I got a new piece.
Let's modify that.
All right.
Roger would probably write a piece because a fairly well-known group would ask him to write.
But no money involved.
The Gallimir Quartet would ask him to write a quartet for them. A pianist would ask him to write a piece for them, but no money. Please.
When did the money situation end? Like one of it is commissioned, of course.
Yes. The money situation didn't start until at least the 50s.
Yeah.
It began that way because of the people who established this precedent of commissions, the Arts Council's name. the NEA, the groups that that commissioned four people. After all, performers don't pay you money these days. It's groups who pay for the performers. There was none of that fund. For example, Aaron Copland's money began to come in as a result of being commissioned to write ballets, films. That's where it came from. Library of Congress did commission, by the way, but no young American composer ever got a Library of Congress commission. They commissioned Bartok and Berg and Prokofiev and Sackler and Aaron Copland. Roger Sessions didn't get a Library of Congress commission in those days, as far as I can remember. I could be wrong about that. There was nothing of that kind. They existed in various ways. They existed either by virtue of having some private money. They existed by virtue of teaching. Remember, Roy Harris was teaching through his great days at the Westminster Choir School. And then he went out and taught at Colorado College. Aaron Copland was the only one who didn't have to teach. And he had some money, and he did even then a lot of lecturing. He taught at the New School for Social Research. Roger Sessions was teaching privately, and then at Princeton. Walter Piston was teaching at Harvard. There's no other way to do it. There were no commissions to speak of.
Well, even commissions wanted.
Of course. For example, after all, let's never forget, Hindemith was teaching at Yale, Schoenberg was teaching at UCLA. The greatest names in the world were all teaching. The only one who wasn't was Stravinsky. And Stravinsky was making a living not as a composer, but as a soprano. It was a very different picture, Tom. I can't tell you. For example, here we are sitting in Juilliard. Well, this would have been unthinkable. Juilliard was uptown.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever went there. It was a school for pianists. Ernest Hutchison was the dean,
violinists,
singers, and nobody went up there. There was never a concert that would ever attract you. That changed the world. Bill Schumann became the director. He began bringing composers in. He began changing the atmosphere of the school. It had no effect. Now, look, let's face it, like it or not, Juilliard, any day in Juilliard you can hear a contemporary piece. Any week in Juilliard you can hear a dozen of them. The orchestra doesn't do much of it, but there's a contemporary group here, and above all, the students are playing it all the time. This was simply the case. There were not young composers around Juilliard in those days. I'm talking about the 30s. Young composers were not anywhere very much, but the extent that they were around, they were either studying with private people, maybe a few around NYU, a few around Columbia, maybe. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Now, in view of that scarcity of composers,
right.
This is a little outside of it. Why, in relationship to that, why now are you getting hoarded with applications?
That's a very good question. I do not know the answer to that.
I'll propose you an answer. No?
Good, please.
You have people living now like Cage. It gets published, and anything goes. I'll draw a picture. And
that's right. That's
all right. There's a 12-note system where people get a bad view of it. Well, we'll use all 12 notes to write it in long. All right, so you have those two.
You mean people are being seduced into it because they're have-nots or will-nots or can-nots in other fields who drift into music because it seems to provide a way to secure them a certain amount of prestige, a certain amount
of
position.
And so they may hear a song on the radio or something, and then they'll whistle a variation to that melody, and they'll go, hey, I just wrote a piece.
Well, on the other hand, Tom, you're being very cynical about it. Let me also say this, that I think one of the answers is the influx of the whole tradition of music suddenly descended upon the United States. We came here in the 30s, the presence of these people, not only were we no longer intimidated, but we were able to profit from their presence in every conceivable way, both what it did to our own self-esteem, and what we were able to learn, and what we were able to teach. That had a great deal to do. The other thing, there's no question about it, too, is the proliferation of just loads of performance that you cannot forget. Records. You suddenly could hear the complete works of Weber when we couldn't hear one. LP records, recording. The economics of recording changed. But remember, there was a time in the late 40s and 50s where there were so many tiny record companies, only anything could be recorded. That, too, has changed back again. There's very little recording of contemporary music left. But that came and went. There was also the fact that, as a result of records, people were listening to it. kids everywhere. And don't forget the universities. We've contributed to this. There is no university now that doesn't have not only a department of music, but a number of composers hanging around teaching there. Theory is now being taught by composers. It's not being taught by theory teachers. There seems to be at least some consumption of our product, so therefore we produce it. I think that in a certain sense that it's just become known as a profession. A kid in the 30s, the idea of being a composer, who is a composer? You've never seen a composer. Now you go to some small school in the backwoods, and the man teaching you first year of harmony calls himself a composer, and indeed may very well be a composer.
But then, no, and you have the songwriters. They used to call themselves songwriters, and
now they call it a composer. Well, that's another story. Yeah. That's another story. Yes, they indeed used to call themselves songwriters. I never heard Irving Berlin or even George Gershwin referred to as a composer until a latter day. But I think that there is the confusion of categories, there is the fragmentation of activity, so that anything is now a self-defined composition is quite right. But also we're tracking on the other side of the coin, I must tell you, that people are now going into composition and have been for about the last 20 years who would never have ended up in music in the old days. Because in those days you were told, well, look, if you wanted to be a composer, you'd better be a pianist. If you want to be a composer, you'd better be a string player. If you want to be a composer, you'd better be prepared to earn a living by conducting the school orchestra, by conducting the school band, by giving piano lessons on the side, as Griffiths did, as a matter of fact, in a boys' school. Now you get intellectuals, people who were seriously interested in other fields, switching over from other fields, because they've discovered that music is, in many ways, more challenging than some other fields. When people say, you know, that physics or engineering is so difficult, they forget that one of the difficulties is keeping your mind off some of that dull stuff. As a teacher of this, I know. I mean, the cookbook differential equations, all of those things are made for a kind of very, very diligent grubber. Many of those people try out and look for other fields that interest them more, and yet make the same comparable demands, and many of them end up in music. We're getting people going in as composers much later. But my generation, nobody would have gone into music, let alone composition, who hadn't gotten involved in the age of 4. You never thought of going into music if you hadn't sort of been brought up in the field. Now we have people turning to music at the age of 18, 19, people switching from one field to another.
Well, I started learning about 15, so I got into music. But you do see it's, still 10 years different.
Yeah, but even, and again, you know, I don't want to take that too seriously, except that, look, when you went to a college in my day, you were not likely to be aware of the fact that people were writing music.
Right.
This was just not an activity that was proper for young men, even women. If they taught music, it was at a girls' finishing school somewhere. The idea that this was seriously a demanding and intriguing subject had all kinds of not only creative interests, but analytical aspects that involved you in some of the most foundational questions of modern intellection. That would never have occurred to anyone.
But now the raises a question, too, that now we have a majority of composers where the ones that were composing in the 30s had to definitely commit themselves, mind, body, and soul, to it, knowing full well that they might know they have done it.
That's true.
But now you have a large majority of composers, like I'm sure you get 100 applications every time you turn around.
That's right.
And some that get in that will at some point give it all up too after they've gotten your degree.
Yeah, either give it all up too or think that, my God, after all, it's one way to get an academic position. Look, that happened in other fields. For example, when I began teaching at Princeton, the number of people who majored in mathematics was about equal to the number of people who majored in music, about 4 a year. After the war, in mathematics, the number went up to about 100. I mean, mathematics had not only become chic, it not only acquired prestige, were people aware of it, but it became practical. You could get a job, you could go up into industry, you could get academic jobs, you could do computer work. Well, that lasted for a while, and now it's almost as hard to get a job teaching mathematics in the university as to get a job teaching music. So, of course, there's going to be the marketplace, and therefore people are going to go into convincing fields, which they normally not. But I think in general that what has happened to Tom is that people are just aware of this. I mean, they're the records. You're perfectly true that they may confuse categories, that they may feel that anything goes. You're perfectly right about that. It may seem to be easy, it may seem to be a way to become famous, celebrated. The confusion of celebrity with achievement is rather considerable in this field. So is it in others. I mean, as long as people read Time magazine or the New York Times, the New Yorker or New York, or you name it, Newsweek, there's bound to be this confusion. There's bound to be this confusion now between even so-called, you know, serious music and rock. But the truth of the matter is, let's try to be honest about it for a moment. In the 30s, it was simply an unknown people. It was just beginning. This was a very, very, very young country from a musical point of view. For all the fact that, that the level of performance in the orchestra, the level of performance in the orchestra was high. No. For example, just look at the literature. There was no perspectives, there was no journal of music theory, there was no In Theory Only. There was no place in the world where you could publish a serious analytical article. The Musical Quarterly was a serious scholarly magazine, but had very little to do with analytical questions and nothing to do with contemporary music. Now, we're still not in the position of the people in the visual arts, where you can go to a newsstand and find 10 fancy, expensive magazines on contemporary art. Some of it very pretentious, too, not just pop stuff. We don't have anything comparable. You go to a newsstand, you can't buy anything on music except record magazines or a hi-fi magazine. But certainly, it's a very different atmosphere, believe me. It's a very different atmosphere. The thought of having the kind of dilemma that I have, for example, in a couple of weeks, where, again, there are going to be two concerts on the same night, and at each of these concerts, many of my colleagues' works are going to be done, and I should be at both concerts. Mm-hmm. There was nothing, you know, if you could find a half dozen concerts in a season involving people you knew, contemporary composers, that except the composer's performance.
Well, I think there's a lot of us think I should title my paper in the beginning.
In the beginning. Well, it was very much in the beginning, Tom. It really was. Because, honestly, look, let's be fair about it. I don't think I could have survived in that or I don't see how I could have done it. I don't care what anybody says about it. If you're going to be a composer, you're going to be a composer. Well, that, of course, is nonsense. It's pure tautology. There's absolutely no empirical. I probably would have gone into some other field. But you'd see, the other side of that coin is that during the Depression, it didn't make any difference what field you went into. There were no jobs. Architects were walking the street. Engineers were walking the streets. Lawyers started at $5 a week. So that, what the hell, why not become a musician? It's no worse than anything else. But I must say this. Of all the people I was in music with at NYU, which was sort of a hotbed of activity in the city at that time, it wasn't during World War II, I do not know the single one of the young composers who were sort of part of our gang. I'm repeating myself now. There may be five or six still functioning. Hugo Weiss, one of the most original composers with Roger. Miriam Gideon, Irving Fine, Vivian Fine, David Diamond. That's it. I've come to the end of the list.
And Carter was...
No, Elliot was... Elliot, first of all, was older, and Elliot was at that time in Paris.
So he was...
And remember that Elliot was one of these people who bloomed very late. Elliot in the 30s was regarded as a very minor figure in the Copland entourage, and so was right through the 40s. Elliot's star broke in about 1950.
And the thing that I'm glad you're telling the composers that were in America at that time, because I tend to exclude the people that were in Europe at
right.
that time.
Right.
It wasn't an American.
There were a few others. Right. I didn't mean to imply those were the only ones. It was Arthur Berger. Now, for example, forgetting any other kinds of considerations, there was the California group, which we didn't know, which would have been John Cage, Lou Harrison, people like that. No. But he was all right. He was beginning, neither was I. We were students. Then there was a... There were a couple of people in the Midwest who were working then, of whom we didn't know. George Pearl was one.
That's it.
Mm. Now, compare this with what goes on. That's what Roger says. You know, Roger says very frankly that, you know, it was easy for him to get a Guggenheim. I mean, there was no competition. I mean, whether they wanted to give him a Guggenheim or not, and he was not exactly one of their fair-haired boys. There was simply no competition. There was nobody around for mm-hmm. years. No, exactly. There really weren't. Yeah. And if you look at the music available, I mean, you will either find the real old-timers, or you will find a few people who need more.
and he drove one of them come to the lake.
Oh, no, that was much later. Yeah. Get up.